Good, then we're going to start. So here we are, week five. We only have 1 week left, but of course we have a whole session left after this, and that's good, because you will remember that at the end of this reading, Rinpoche says something like, we're not ready to really do this yet. So it's good to know that we have a whole other session to do it. What is the doing? Well, it has to do with inviting space back into appearance. I guess that's a reasonable shorthand. But that's just a preamble. Let me start with a practical announcement. Kathleen included it in the invitation yesterday, but I want to mention it to people because it's important. We're going to have to change the date of the retreat for those of you who are planning on coming. So our preferred date at this point is July 26th through 30th, I believe it is. I wrote it down somewhere, but I think that's right. Kathleen, tell me if I'm not right.
That's correct.
Thank you. So that's when the retreat is being moved to. So I hope nobody has bought their tickets or let us know what kinds of issues or problems that raises. If you can't make it that date, and if there are a couple of alternates in August, but I chose the date that was closest to what we had originally set, and I'm very sorry for having to make the change. Circumstances beyond our control, as they say. Okay, and let me make one other practical announcement. There was an addendum to the orientation that I posted a couple of days ago. It was in response to a cry for help. Somebody said, what in the world did that walkabout mean? So I tried to elaborate on it a little bit, and I hope you find that helpful. But in the first instance, I hope you just know that it's there, the addendum, and you can look for it. Okay, so let's get started on the reading today. As is usually the case, I'm going to take a few minutes to set up the reading. Probably the first 20 minutes or so, we'll have to see. I think I may say something in the orientation for next week, why I do it that way, because I know people have said, well, can't we start off with a practice? And I did try that a couple of times, but in the end, I've wound up feeling that I want to set up the practice. And in this last week, I was reflecting on why I do it that way. And I want to share my thoughts with you. It doesn't mean that it's the right way to do it. It's the way that I do it. And it makes sense to me. And I'll try to explain why, and hopefully that will be helpful for you, especially those of you who are in the teacher training program, to think about that. Okay, so we'll start with that setup, and then we'll get to the practice, and then we'll go as far as we can in the rest of the material. A quick review. The basic theme that we've been examining is that we see the world in terms of substance. We see reality in terms of substance. There's the kind of substance that things have, and then there's the kind of substance that the self has, and you could say the world of the self. I think that would be fair. In other words, the thoughts that we have and so on have their own special kind of substance, even though that's not usually how the term is used in English. But the general point is that we see everything in terms of substance, and I suppose the common sense view, if you said, well, why is that? The answer would be, well, because it's substantial, right? rocks, when you kick them, they hurt your foot. So that's what substance is all about. But the approach that we've been exploring says something very different, and it's not this is not being presented as a theory. It's presented, and of course you know that by now, but I'm going to restate it anyway. It's presented as a different way of seeing what's going on when we encounter substance. So what's going on is that we give names to the things that we encounter. And the act of giving a name has the consequence that we understand the thing to be a thing. You know, how can something have a name if it's not there? So in giving it a name, we say it's there. And that really is what makes substance. And so because something has substance, it has properties. And one of the properties of things like rocks being solid, one that particular property and all the other properties we come up with or notice or discover really go along with the identity that we give to the thing, the name which leads to an identity. So there's actually a very nice statement that I'm going to refer to a couple of times in the course of the class today that's from an earlier reading. It's on page 23 of the reading. Seems to me to be really important. It's at the very top of page 23, and it talks about how ordinary knowing, well, go down to the bottom of 22, ordinary knowing confirms appearance as the realness of the real. It pronounces the interior of the surface. Now, this may all sound a little bit obscure, but if you just take the words very literally and think about them, I think it's really clear. It pronounces the interior of the surface, the substance of what is. So we name something and we what appears is the surface of the thing. We always only ever see the surface of things. And you could say, well, that's seeing, but what about touching? It's still the same thing. We always touch the surface of something. But we posit an interior. So we pronounce, as he says here, the interior of the surface. And then he says, and this is in italics, and this is, I think, because it's a very key point, he says, the interior pronounced in this way remains a surface phenomenon. So what does that mean? We probably talked about this before, but what it means is, as I understand it anyway, is that the properties that we assign, the identities that we assign to the things we encounter, postulate or insist that they do have an interior. But that's just something about the name, something about the identity that we've assigned. We don't actually make contact with that interior, right? The interior remains a surface phenomenon. It's part of the appearance of the thing that it has this assumed interior. So what that means is that the world that we live in, because it's a world of substance, is actually, you know, we like to say, well, empiricism is it has to do with the world as it is. You know, we what we experience through our senses, that's the only thing that's real. Generally speaking, in modern thought, really especially Anglo-American philosophy or let's say science, that's probably a better place to look. Generally speaking, we say the only thing that I can accept as real is what I experience through my senses. That's what's you know, that's what I can rely on, what's being said here is that actually that's exactly the other way around. What we experience through our senses is appearance. That's fine. That's the surface, and that appearance is not wrong. And when appearance tells us that there's a substance underneath, that's a trustworthy statement in the sense that we can act on it. But it doesn't actually establish anything underneath. That's just part of the surface. That's part of appearance. Part of when something appears, I'm sort of repeating myself, but it's such a key point. We want to get clear on it. When we establish the appearance of something and say, well, and it's substantial, it's real, that's part of the appearance of it, that it's a real thing. It appears as something that has an interior. But that's just a hypothesis, it's just a theory. So actually we're living in a very abstract world. We're living in a world in which what matters is the names, the identity that we assign. So you know, that doesn't mean that it's because we assign these names that things come into existence. No, it means that the things that we identify as existing have that property of existing because that's the identity we give them. What I just said is actually not so clear, but I don't want to go into it anymore at this point. I don't think it's essential to do so. I hope not. So we live in this very funny world in which we never really are in contact with what we think is most immediate and most directly available to us. There's a very nice image in Love of Knowledge that many of you probably remember. I can't remember if it's in the reading we've done already, where Rinpoche says, the way we engage the world is like somebody who's trying to touch a fur coat while wearing gloves. You know, we think we're in contact with the thing, especially because we don't realize that we're wearing gloves, but we're actually missing the whole. We're missing it, you know. It's not there. We're just kind of, we have the idea of a fur coat, but there's nothing to back it up. So you could say that we are very fundamentally confused, and that matters a lot. You know, at the most basic level, we misunderstand what the world is like. And I think that's something central in the TSK vision. You know, in you can find different places in what Rinpoche writes where he says things a little differently. But I think it's fair to say that knowledge is really fundamental in the TSK vision. And our knowledge of the world is a mistaken knowledge. It's a confused knowledge. We get it wrong from the very beginning, from the ground up. So everything we build on that basis is going to lead us in the wrong directions because we're starting from the wrong basis. So there are a lot of meditative traditions or. That's mostly what I'm thinking of right now, or philosophical traditions or ideas, which I think start from that same mistaken basis. In fact, mostly that's where people start from, is the idea that substance is what's fundamental. And that is inevitably bound up with the sense of dissatisfaction. Because we live in a world that, you know, nothing works right because because we never got it right. You know, it's as though we installed an operating system on our computer, but we installed the wrong operating system, and nothing really works. We keep pushing the buttons, and it kind of looks like it works, but nothing works. So it has to do with that fundamental confusion. There is an objection to that, I think, that one could make. Oh, look, there are people, I haven't been looking at the chat box. There's all sorts of people commenting. So Ron has, it's mostly Ron commenting. He wrote several different things. He says, works better for me. I'm not quite sure what he's referring to there. But then he says, so this is sort of an equivalent to Madhyamaka deconstruction of things as self-existing. You know, I'm very strongly attuned to Rinpoche's insistence that he's not presenting Buddhist ideas. Having said that, yes, I do think it's similar, maybe not quite equivalent, but very closely related to to that teaching in the Madhyamaka school of Buddhist philosophy. That things do not have an independent existence. You know, Madhyamaka has its own subtleties, and TSK may not go in those directions. TSK, maybe you could say, has its own subtleties, but there's a very strong family resemblance. Let's put it that way. And Ron says, so could you say it's surface all the way down? And yes, I think that's right. And that's why there are certain schools of Western thought that say something kind of similar. So on the one hand, you could say on one side you have Buddhism, on the other side you have Western philosophy. If you could see my hands, you'd see they're kind of spread out in two directions here. And in a sense, in between is TSK. The thing about the Western insight into this is that there, you know, Western philosophy never gives you a very good way of getting there. Or that sounds too goal-oriented, but it never gives you a way of really investigating this in a heartfelt way. TSK does. So yeah, surface all the way down, you could say that. And then Ron says psychedelics, you know, seem to be take us to that place where the surface substance relation unravels. And I'm not going to comment on that, other than to say that, you know, people have very different experiences in psychedelics. But if someone were guiding you, I suppose, in a psychedelic experience, they could guide you in this direction, and it might make readily make sense to you. So Michael says, when the interior is space, like a room in a house we view from outside but then enter, doesn't the notion of an interior get confirmed? Exploration such as of the TSK vision seems to invite getting inside. Or does knowledge invite exploring its interior, but with space, that's never possible? I think you'd have to... I don't know how to comment on that, Michael, because I don't think I understand it. So maybe you could restate it. I'll give you a chance. I'm sorry not to be... I just don't have a place to grab onto that. And Caroline asks, can you not know the interiority of a thing, even if you can't sense it? And then she says, as space has properties, I don't know, then maybe we need to expand our definition of the meaning of the word substance. Well, those would be two different approaches to take. One would have to do with knowing the interiority of the thing, even if you can't sense it. Well, I think that's related to the possibility that that Rinpoche raises here about knowing, a knowing that is not, you know, that is deeper than the distinction between knowing and not knowing. We'll have to get into that later. So yes, there would be a way of knowing the interiority, but probably the first thing to say about that is that what we've already seen and talked about this morning is that we know the interiority in the sense that we know that it's actually a surface phenomenon, right? But I think you're pointing to something different, you can actually, you know, if you look at a rose, let's say, you can have a sense of the roseness of the rose, you know. If you engage a person and you feel great love for that person, that's a kind of a knowing. And it's, if you say, well, that's a surface phenomenon, okay, but it seems like you're missing something. There is a possibility that is available here, that we'd like to be able to get to. And I think in general that's right. And Rinpoche does talk about this. I can't remember if it's in this chapter right now, but certainly if you look at some of the exercises, for instance, in the TSK book or here in the Dynamics book, Rinpoche talks about the possibility of opening the senses. So you say, well, opening the senses to what? If you're not opening them to the thing itself, because that's always a surface phenomenon, what are you opening them to? And I think one way to think about that is you're really opening to the space, which is within the appearance. So when you go into the heart of something, you're actually going into the space fullness, the space openness, which is where we are headed. As to the notion that space has properties, well, you know, not in the way that Rinpoche is talking about properties right here. In some context, maybe you could say that. Okay, Michael says something, and perhaps is reformulating what he said before, but maybe it's something else. Perhaps the surface of knowledge is the names and labels we cloak experience with. But knowing with knowing eyes could be thought of residing inside knowledge. Well, yes, there is a deeper knowing, and that is exactly where Rinpoche wants to take us. He says the kind of knowing that we rely on can't ever take us beyond the surface and is always going to be colored by this fundamental mistake we make, which is that we always think we're going beyond the surface. That's the common sense or the ordinary understanding. We'd like to be able to go to a different knowledge. So you're calling it an inside knowledge. Right. As Michael knows, and I may have mentioned to some of you, there's going to be a book coming out soon, which is some readings from TSK with some commentary by me, called Inside Knowledge. And this is a good place to look at that. So I assume Michael's putting in a slight plug for that for that book. Ron says, good art does this. Yeah, art is another place. And Rinpoche points to that many times. You know, he will talk about sense experience. He will talk about the power of art. In the reading we did for last week, he says there are ways into this, but they require, you know, maybe they require tremendous effort, or maybe they require some kind of special genius. We're trying to find something where it's just natural. You don't have to make a special effort. It has to do with seeing with different eyes, as Michael pointed out here, and as Rinpoche says, I think at the beginning of this chapter, it has to do with seeing with different eyes. And they're not form eyes or substance eyes. They're vision eyes. They're space eyes. Yeah, it's right at the beginning of the chapter. We always see
recognizing all appearance as knowledge.
Well, that's another way to say it. Absolutely, that's very good. I think that says it well. And I'm not going to try to comment on it further. Okay, we should keep moving because we should move on. I mean, these are great things that people are pointing out. It's very good. But I do want to say some more and get us to a practice and see where we go from there. So we are looking for a different kind of knowledge. And the way to do that is to open, and here I'm quoting the very end of the last chapter that we read for last week. He says, we arrive at the nameless and the formless, and that is the kind of knowledge we're looking at. Right? It's very interesting. How can there be knowledge without name and without form? That's what we're asking. We arrive at the nameless and the formless by opening appearance to space. That's where we're headed. You know, there's a really strong momentum, you could say, even though that's a charged word in TSK, so maybe we don't want to use it, but I'm going to use it. There's a kind of a thrust, a drive, a momentum in this section on space that says, you know, we're wanting to evoke or activate this vision, being able to see with knowledge eyes, as he says here on page 29. And we do that by opening appearance to space. Okay. And so when that happens, or maybe that's not the right way to say it, what Rinpoche says about that is that it is the quality of it is remarkably different from our ordinary understanding. So in the second paragraph on page 29, we're exchanging form eyes for space eyes, he says. And then he says, when that happens, we can find nourishment in food that has no substance and delight in touching what has no texture. And again, that might just sound evocative, but you know, I've mentioned before, I think, in here that when Rinpoche says things that sound like you can kind of, you say, oh, that's inspiring. Well, hopefully it is. But it's also precise. And I think in this case, the precision is pretty clear. The precision is exactly, you know, the things that appear don't have substance. And the things that we touch, we could say, don't have texture, which is a kind of substance for our purposes, or you could say don't have form. And yet, that doesn't detract from the experience. It adds to the experience. It makes them that much more rich, you know, that much more nourishing, that much more delightful, right? And it's a very fundamental change. So just to emphasize this point, because again, it's very central, the tendency, because we're so committed to substance, is to say, if we move into a world of space, well, everything becomes ghostly. You know, everything becomes insignificant. Everything that we thought had value or importance and meaning is just a kind of a form. You know, just a phantom. And there is a sense from the point of view of ordinary knowledge where perhaps that description works, but it doesn't work in terms of what Rinpoche is saying here. Something can lose substance. That is to say, a better way to say that is substance can lose its claim to being the kind of mysterious interior of what appears, the thing that we assume has to be there. All that can kind of disappear. But that doesn't make things less rich. It just kind of... I can't think of a great analogy right now, but it just kind of wipes out that level, but it doesn't change in any way our ability to appreciate and engage. And in fact, it makes it much richer because we're no longer committed in the same way to holding a certain position. So again, if you go to that quote on page 23, I'm going to read just a little bit farther in that same place. We saw already the interior pronounced in this way remains a surface phenomenon. And then he goes on, nothing is established. The dance remains a dance. There are only the echoes of the field communique. And if we have time today, and I don't think we will, but I'll save so in the orientation, I'll go back and try to make that connection to the field communique more clear. But the image... it's very nice, you know, the dance remains a dance. You know, you could imagine looking at a dance and freezing each moment in the dance, and in effect that's what we do. But then we lose the dance. But here, the dance remains a dance. So there's actually a good image for that, it occurs to me, is many of you have probably seen this. When photography was invented, one of the questions that scientists set out to answer was whether when horses galloped, there was a point in the gallop when they had all 4 feet off the ground at the same time. Because they moved too fast. People disagreed. They couldn't tell for sure. So they did stop-motion photography, a very early version of it. And there's a famous series of photographs that shows that, in which, and in fact you see, the horse has all of its feet off the ground at the same time. But it's a wonderful example. You say, well, that's the scientific inquiry. You freeze each moment, and now you've learned some new fact about the way that horses gallop. But of course, that set of frozen pictures doesn't tell you anything about the dance of the gallop, you know, the movement of the gallop. So it's a nice image for what's going on here. Okay, well, I think I'm not going to talk about something that I was, which is that this claim or this not a claim, the point that Rinpoche makes that things have disappeared, that space has disappeared not only once but twice. And let me say something quick about it. I think the basic idea here is that if you think of space as an object, it can't be an object because it has no substance by definition, and objects have to have substance. So in a world of objects, space disappears. It just can't be there. But it disappears a second time because whatever appears in the world is something that's known by a subject through its properties. And space has no properties. I know what Caroline said, so maybe there'll be a time at some point when we can get back into that. But there's nothing that you can take hold of and assign to space as a property. So that's its second example. Okay. So now we're almost at the point where we can do a little bit of practice. That was sort of setting things up a little, and a lot of it is material that we've already discussed. Ron has another comment here. He says, substance ties in to Rinpoche's notion of the gravity of identity, which is a freezing of space and time, and a downshifting. That's a word that I guarantee you doesn't show up in TSK, but it's a good word. A downshifting of the vitality and flow of appearance. It is related to gravity. And gravity comes up in dynamics. I think it may come up actually later in the next session. I don't quite remember for sure. But yes, it's a related phenomenon, a related point. The gravity of thinking or the gravity of assigning identity freezes space and time. Okay, so we are, the move that we want to make at this point, we want to say, how can we move away from the claims of substance and toward space within appearance? And the first step is the point that Rinpoche makes on page 31, or probably it's on page 30 actually, the point that when you look at appearance, you inevitably are also looking at space, because whatever appears needs space. This is actually a point, I suppose, and I think we are well along in our explorations here, and that probably strikes people as fairly clear, maybe not. But most people would say, well, wait a minute, things appear, at least in some sense, and they have nothing to do with space. So, for instance, a memory appears in my mind, and that has nothing to do with space. But, of course, the answer to that is that the notion of space that we're working with here is much broader than physical space. Physical space is a particular example of space in the sense of what accommodates. So you could talk about mental space, for example, to deal with the question of memory or other mental phenomena. So in that sense, whatever appears has to appear in a space that accommodates it. There's no way of appearing without that. That's a pretty fundamental point. You know, there are people who, some Western philosophers have argued, well, space, there is no such thing as space. When we talk about space, we're just talking about the relationship between things. So, you know, so space is a way of measuring the relationship between things. You know, that would be a philosophical argument. Maybe you'd wind up using a different vocabulary if you were talking with people like that. But the vocabulary that we're using, which I think works very well, is simply to say that in order for something to appear, it has to appear in its own space. And what that means is that whatever appears, appears in space. So that you can find space, and this is the move then that we want to make, you can find space within appearance. In every appearance, space has to be active, or there is no appearing. And since that's so, we have the possibility of finding, of gaining access to space in appearance. We don't have to go somewhere else, right? But having said that, you say, well, okay, show me the space in this appearance here. You know, here's this table, where's the space? So, you know, I talk about the physics of it and atoms and the space inside atoms. That's not the point. The point is much more, it goes in a different direction. The point is that in order for the table to appear, there has to be the space in which it appears, and we want to gain access to that space. But because we don't know how, there isn't any way to gain access to that space in terms of our substance-centered, ordinary way of understanding. Since that's so, space is mysterious. And you know, this section that starts on page 30 is called Space as the Central Mystery. And it's you know, it's a very interesting kind of TSK move that says, oh, you want more knowledge? Well, look at what's mysterious. Look at what you don't understand. Space is a mystery because we can't gain access to it in our ordinary understanding. So we need to be able to engage that mystery. And that's hard because, you know, really, if space is necessary for appearance, and if appearance and space is mysterious, then it follows, maybe not in a logical way, but I think you can see, it follows that appearance itself is mysterious. And so there's a whole set of questions that come up, and this is where I want us to be able to do a little practice here. So in the second full paragraph on page 31, Rinpoche says, the non-availability of space for knowledge, because it's disappeared, we've already looked at that, that non-availability means that mystery is at the heart of all appearance. Not knowing space, there's really nothing that we know with certainty. So the mystery of space becomes the mystery of appearance. And that mystery is where we want to look. And as I said, that's a very lovely move and characteristic move that you find in the TSK vision. And then in the next paragraph, paragraph 3, he asks a number of questions. Or he raises a number of questions. He says, the mystery of appearance can be phrased in many ways. There is the fundamental question of why anything appears at all, rather than nothing. There is the nature of the mechanism that allows appearing. There is the nature of the creative force that sets the mechanism in operation. There is the conflict between the active and ever-shifting arising of appearance on the one hand and the fixed identity of what is and what can be known on the other. So those are a series of questions. And here is one place where I want to make a comparison that, you know, I'm not really qualified to make, but it kind of strikes me anyway. It's just like I'm not qualified to make comparisons to physics, you know, and to, let's say, you know, matter is only waves in space, probability waves in space. I can say that, but I don't really know what I mean. The comparison I want to make here is to koans in the Zen tradition. And I may be completely off on that because I've never studied in the Zen tradition. But it kind of has that sense. The questions that are being asked here, at least to me, the questions that are being asked here are questions that you want to take away and ponder. Right? And as Rinpoche says at the bottom of page 31, what's most interesting about such questions is that their significance escapes us. Right? Their significance has already disappeared. And that seems to me, from what the little bit I know, to be true of koans also, so that's why I'm raising it as an analogy. You ask the question, and you give an answer which ignores the significance of the question. You have to be able to find your way back into the significance of the question. And so I wanted us to practice for a few minutes now, and it's probably going to take up all our time, so I'll have more to say in the orientation, with just one of these questions. So he gives about four questions in this paragraph, and any one of them is the kind of question that you could take away with you, that you could try to engage the significance of for a long time. And as most of you know, I'm sure, at least as well as I do, in koan practice, you wrestle with these questions, you know. And I think it's actually a nice way of thinking to say that it's not because you're trying to find an answer, it's because you're trying to understand the significance of the question. And Ron, who has a little more experience in this than I do, says, yeah, it's koan-like. Okay, so the question that I would like us to look at that's taken from that paragraph is, how does something come to appear? And what I have in mind is that you look at that in a very immediate sense. So you find something around you to engage and ask yourself the question, how does it come to appear? So there's a causal explanation, somebody put it there, or somebody mined the metal out of which it's made. But obviously we're looking deeper than that. How does something come to appear? What is the way in which something shows up? How language is not going to get us there, but if we start looking at the question, trying to understand the significance, how does it lead us back into the mystery of space is another way of saying it, but that's saying too much. We just want to ask the question in a very fresh way. How does something come to appear? And I guess that's, the way it's phrased in the book is the mechanism that allows appearing and the nature of the creative force. This is really more the creative force, I think, responsible for setting that mechanism in operation. How does something come to appear? So look around you, find things, engage things, and ask yourself, how does it come to appear? Let's do that for a few minutes, okay? Okay. So let's come back together. We're running out of time, but I will certainly stay on to see what people have to say. Anybody who has to leave, of course, is welcome to leave, but I do want to give people a chance to comment on this. Okay.
So, and appearances seem to be forms of knowledge.
Appearances seem to be forms of knowledge. Okay. Okay, so that's similar to what you said earlier, Hayward.
It seems so apparent.
Right, it keeps staring you in the face, I understand. okay, so the question is, of course we're only going to get to verbal formulations, right? Right now when we're talking. So what underlies that formulation? And the sense is, does that lead you back into the underlying mystery of space? Now, I think the way you're coming at it, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the way you're coming at it, it seems good, but is, you shift from the mystery of space appearance to the kind of universal presence of knowledge.
How it's known, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And those may be two ways of talking about the same thing. They on the surface.
I appreciate what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So Klaus says something very similar. I'm just starting to look at the written comments. Klaus says there needs to be a knower, or at least a knowing quality. Right. So, of course, the tendency is to say there needs to be a knower, and by the way, that's me, in case you hadn't noticed. Then you correct that to say a knowing quality. It does seem that for something to appear, there needs to be some knowing, right? And earlier in the chapter, Rinpoche has talked about, or maybe the previous chapter, Rinpoche has talked about this. On the one hand, there's the appearance of the object, and on the other hand, there are the properties that the knower knows. That's our ordinary understanding. So yeah, that's something to point to for sure. Caroline says, the cup, that's her object, I guess, a desire to drink. So that goes along with it, right? That appears with it. Stability of conditions, which hold it in form. The plant, is that the plant that gives us the tea? I'm just imagining. Historic biological habit, an impulse of life combined with human desire. So I'm going to generalize from what you say there, Caroline, and just say for something to appear, there's a hole, right? There's the desire, there's the cup, which immediately stimulates the desire to drink, because I guess there's something in the cup, or you wish there were something in the cup. And all of that appears together. And so the generalization I want to make, because that takes us in the direction or back to the field communique, and I'll say something about that in the transition, you could say, if you say, well, what's the answer to the question? How does something come to appear? Well, you could give an answer in terms of the field communique, or you could give it, that's not the only way, but you see, there's got to be a wholeness. It's what's communicated. That's how it appears. It appears because it's communicated. But of course, that answer, that's not exactly what we're looking for. It's maybe a helpful place to go, but you can't stop and say, "Oh, that's a good answer." That will get me a good grade on the exam. It has to be an opening to the mystery. At least I think that's what's being asked for here. Let's see. There's so many comments. They've scrolled off my screen. Okay, David says, how does something come to appear? How does something come to appear? An object comes into view initially as raw, untamed, Intellectually, it's a play of light or movement or lines and planes that's different from adjacent objects. So we haven't assigned identity. But I think you're saying that intellectually we could say, we're the ones who then go ahead and assign identity. And then he goes on, then an intellectual process of differentiation occurs involving memory, this and not that. Ron's not sure he understood that, but I'm going to let it rest. I think you're saying there's a... you can analyze the movement through which something appears in an act of naming. And this, again, brings in the quality of knowing, which all the comments so far have brought in. There has to be a knowing. That's a part of the how of how something appears. And you're analyzing it, David, in terms of these different steps intellectually. Okay. And Ken says... it appears that knowing is the arising of appearance. And Ron says that sounds too much like TSK talk, TSK speak. And I don't see that that Ken has responded again, but let's see, there's a lot. No, he hasn't come back to it. Okay, well, I think we've said enough in the last few minutes that I'll let that rest. It's that, you know, you can see why, it seems to me, you can see why Ken might formulate it that way. Sudhi says, like a non-lucid dream, I'm always baffled by what appears in retrospective looking. So, if I understand correctly, you're saying, so in a dream, you look back, you wake up, and you say, wow, what an incredible set of images there were in that dream, or an incredible set of events. And sometimes, even when you're not dreaming, you know, if you watch the flow of activity in the mind, they're just remarkable images. It's amazing. And there's so much that's amazing in what appears. The other day I was describing something and I used a word that, you know, I don't know if I've ever said it before. I know it, but I don't know that I've ever said it before. And it just came right to mind. That's mysterious. It seems to me it's mysterious. You know, it's so available. Knowledge is so available. And that in itself is a kind of appearance, though I don't want to ride that idea too hard. Okay. Michael says, the branches of a living tree compared to a brick wall, so you were looking at both, I imagine, maybe not, may both appear as a surface. However, the tree seems to branch forth from a deeper time, spring budding out from winter, and a deeper space, rain, dirt, seeds sprouting, and thereby invites a wider realm of knowledge. Yeah. Well, that's nice. I imagine, suppose you were the one who had put that brick wall in place, or suppose you had actually, you know, dug the clay which eventually was fired to make the bricks. You know, then that might be just as rich, right? I'm not sure. I mean, it wouldn't be rich in the same way, but it would be rich. But that richness, again, that wholeness that is related to knowing, I think people are really all tending to point in the same way. And Sudhi says, but I think maybe she's continuing on with her previous thought. I'm always baffled by what appears, she said before, and rarely, okay, I see that retrospectively and then rarely as it is happening. So that would be if the dream becomes lucid, right? There's no clarity of how it comes to being. Right. I suppose that's why I pointed to finding the right word instantly. There's this mystery. There's always a mystery in the moment of what appears. It's kind of remarkable. It's always there. Okay, and Karin says, asking these questions makes me feel a bit lost, and I suppose I should applaud, right? That's the idea. It's a mystery, right? Feeling the miracle of life beyond knowledge. So yes, it's a knowledge that is deeper than the knowledge where you can separate out knowing from not knowing. That's really where we're going. And Phil says, how does something arise? I guess he's summarizing our question. I, as a knower, am a screen where a particular moment in the constant change of space is projected, paralyzed as something. I like that word, paralyzed. Again, not a word that shows up in TSK, I don't think. Usually a typical image there is frozen. But you could say, yes, there's kind of an instant paralysis of what shows up. And we are we're complicit in it, right? It's a conspiracy between I and the world that the I knows to paralyze the dynamic aliveness of what appears, right? So it's a nice image. I am a screen where a particular moment is projected. If I remove the screen, I return to the mystery of space, to the dance. And Ron ends, he's going to end it for us because we're going to stop now by saying, speechless, speechless. Okay, we will end our speech. I'll say a little more in the orientation. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you.